Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Americans have finally begun to recognize that human-caused climate change is a grave threat to humanity. What is less clear is the dangerous effects climate change will have on the entire ecosphere. Roger Schlickhuysen is president of Defenders of Wildlife.
First of all, you've got to get the legislation. You've got to cap the emissions, but that's the only train that's going to leave on this. You've got to have, if it's global warming legislation and it deals with the problem, it has to both cap emissions and it has to deal with the impact on biological diversity. Or future generations, to paraphrase Ed Wilson, are going to look back on us and blame us for this, and they will be right to do so.
Was Ed Wilson that said that we are in the midst of another great extinction event. The difference is, instead of being an asteroid, it's humans.
Well, that's right, and they've been saying that for decades. And that's before you put the impact of global warming on top of that. I mean, we could lose 35-40% of our species. You know, talk about tearing holes in the web of life. The web of life can tolerate a certain amount of insult. But not at that level. You're going to be causing damage here, and anybody will get that intrinsically if they have a chance to think about it.
Since 1991, Roger Schlickhuysen has led Defenders of Wildlife. By 2009, the organization had grown from 61,000 members to 500,000, with a budget of more than $30 million. Mr. Schlickhuysen holds an MBA from Harvard and a doctorate in finance from George Washington University. Bill Russell and I were pleased to have the opportunity to discuss the future of the planet with Roger Schlickhuysen. Roger Schlickhuysen, I have a fond memory of growing up in a town that had a very beautiful bridge, and early on I spotted that thing in the middle that is a keystone. Well, I was thinking about that keystone to the bridge when I was trying, after years and years and years of puzzling, to figure out why you have a wolf as a defender of wildlife icon. I decided the wolf was a keystone. How'd I do?
You did well. You did well. No, the wolf, in fact, is a keystone species, Paul, and we have now seen that, especially at work in Yellowstone. Defenders of Wildlife was, I think, the lead organization, most people would agree, in getting the wolves back into the Northern Rockies and into Yellowstone Park. And the studies that have been made since then show just the important role that the top predator plays in an ecosystem.
And it's the wolf that is the top predator?
The wolf is the top predator in the Yellowstone ecosystem by far.
I would have thought it would be a grizzly bear.
No, the grizzly bear is an important predator, but it's really an omnivore. The wolf is a carnivore, and it is the top predator. And it, in fact, puts a lot of meat on the ground for the grizzly bear. So it is the top predator there.
How convenient for the grizzly bear.
And its return has made, I don't know how long it's been since you've been to Yellowstone, but its return has made Yellowstone a much more dynamic place.
Dynamic
in the sense that this age-old predator-prey relationship that's been there forever is now playing itself out again, and guests that come can actually see it before their very eyes. It gives you a little bit of a flavor of what wild America once was like. Probably you get that better, at least in the lower 48, you get that better now in Yellowstone than you do any place else in America.
So you watch wolves go out and kill things?
If you're lucky, yes.
When we heard that you were coming and that we would have the chance to spend some time with you, I was very enthusiastic because I have been trying, particularly for the last 6 or 8 months, to figure out what it is about a certain set of humans that they want to go out and kill wolves, particularly given what you've just said. And I, in sort of an abstract sense, can sort of understand it, but I'm really mystified by this obsession with killing wolves.
Slaughtering wolves.
What's it about?
Well, I think it goes back, you know, a long, long, long ways. It goes back all the way probably to Aesop's fable. Why Aesop decided to pick on the wolf, I have no idea. But all of those stories that come out from all of that over the centuries actually have created this, I think. And it just created the wolf as a symbol of wild and dangerous nature, unfortunately. And we keep playing that out. That in spite of the fact that to this day there is no known incident of a wild wolf ever killing a human being in the United States.
Really?
Yes, yes. And when we returned wolves to Yellowstone shortly thereafter, I had an occasion. We worked quite closely with the Yellowstone Wolf Recovery Project, and I had an occasion to actually be in a pen about maybe a half an acre in size when we were trying to capture some of these wolves to move them to another location. And we were trying, this was kind of silly as you look back on it, but they were trying a new experiment where they were trying to actually net them. Rather than tranquilize them, they were trying to net them. And so here we were trying to put in nets
on paper
on these big wolves, you know, 80, 120 pound wolves running around there, and we're trying to net them. And it was, but we were there knowing that we really weren't in danger. I do have to admit that my heart was a bit up in my throat doing this, but I wouldn't have been there I thought that I was in any danger, and these wolves would do everything but run between your legs trying to get away from you.
This reminds me of Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who wrote, and probably best known for writing, The Hidden Life of Dogs. Mm-hmm. And she maintains, maybe with a little bit of her tongue in cheek, that it was actually wolves who domesticated us rather than the other way around, that is to say, what became dogs. That they, and sort of like the grizzlies with the wolves, mm-hmm. the wolves figured out that there was some easy fixings around, and they over time, she argues, domesticated us. But this is a long-standing relationship.
Oh yes, oh yes. I mean, it's amazing how many people are unaware that all of our domestic dogs evolved from wolves. All of them, little ones, big ones. I mean, they all came from dogs. And people can only speculate about what happened, but you can almost see in your mind, you know, the first time, you know, a wolf came by a campfire and decided, you know, this was easy pickings, kind of. And the humans that were there decided, you know, this was pretty good, too. I didn't mind this, you know, and the animal may help protect the camp. And so they developed a little symbiotic relationship where they each did something for the other. And out of all that evolved all of our domestic dogs. I think if more people realized that our domestic dogs came from wolves, there would be more sympathy for them, for wolves, than there are.
Absolutely. Roger Schlickhuysen is our guest. He is the president of the Defenders of Wildlife. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Mr. Schlickhuysen, we'll all be back in just a moment. Be with us. We're delighted to be with Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of the wonderful Defenders of Wildlife. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. Mr. Schlickhuysen, I have to say, it puzzles me in that same vein as Bill was saying, why didn't we pick Romulus and Remus and the wolf mothering the beginning of the Roman Empire? Why not that image? Because that the nurturing, the bonding, the mother puppy relationship, that's as strong in the story of the wolf as Little Red Riding Hood.
I can't tell you why we didn't pick it. It certainly would have worked out better for the wolf if we had, actually for us.
And for humans.
For us.
Seems to me that we overlook what we lose by being killers of wolves.
We have had at least 8 years, and arguably a lot longer, of denial of reality. Science went by the board, research, evidence, all of those kinds of things, as a matter of essentially federal policy, and it infected large parts of the nation. The evidence, if we can get people to look at evidence, is simply overwhelming that having these, what Paul characterizes, keystone creatures, the big predators, charismatic megafauna, in another context, that those people are essential in a healthy environment.
You mean the wolf people?
I mean wolves, but also not just wolves. That is characterism. This is ecology. This is a rich, complex system, and it requires its primary predators. Other than humans.
Oh, it does. It does. I mean, there's almost all species, and I'm going to say almost all, have a very worthwhile function that they perform. I mean, there's a reason we talk about the web of life. We all are interconnected in this, and there is a role that all these species play, and especially predator species and keystone species. Keystone species, and they can be small in the big prairie grasslands of the West. The prairie dog is a keystone species. It's kind of nature's Big Mac. Feeds a lot of other things.
And what exactly does that mean? a keystone species?
A keystone species, well, it was, I think you started with the It's kind of what holds the ecosystem together, if you will, and keeps it viable, that keeps it healthy. It performs these functions that make the ecosystem biologically more rich than it would be. You mentioned the idea of the wolf and being a keystone species, and I said a little while ago that when they brought the wolf back, they could, that's when they really were aware of this. And I'll abbreviate the story, but just to give you a sense of it, I think most people will agree that Yellowstone Park was overpopulated with elk before. There is some debate about it, but most people, I think that park was overpopulated with elk. Well, when it's overpopulated with elk, then they browse, these basically being browsing animals, they browse and they take the vegetation down. Well, with the vegetation down, that provides for a lot of other wildlife aren't there. So when they brought the wolf back, the elk numbers dropped somewhat, but more important than the elk numbers dropping, when the wolves came back, they forced the elk to move around because they were preying on the elk, and so they wouldn't spend all of their time in the valleys. And since they didn't spend all of their time in the valleys, then the vegetation there, and especially the willows and the aspen, had a chance to grow again. And as the willow and the aspen grew, and they shaded the river was cooler, it ended up supporting more fish. Because you have willow and aspen, the beavers came back because they had something to eat and something to build dams with. And the birds had something more to nest in, so the birds came back. And the beavers build the dams, create the wetlands. Then the ducks come back. All of this life is back. It is much more biologically rich than it was before. And it's all providing food for each other in this process. And it is a more dynamic, more exciting, and biologically rich ecosystem than it was before. And it was, in this case, it was the top predator with their actions kind of at the top of the food chain, kind of cascading down through the ecosystem and all these other species, benefiting them. So that's an example of a keystone species kind of at the top of the predator chain. I already mentioned the prairie dog is a keystone species because so many things, birds of prey, for example, black-footed ferrets, feed off of the prairie dog, and so you get them at both ends.
But it doesn't have to be in a park for this.
It's in fact, it's at work everywhere, and because humans are there now developing all this, and kind of, if we're not careful, the ecosystem isn't healthy because we're taking this species out or that species out of it, and the ecosystem changes then because we're, and if you happen to get one of the keystone species in the process, then it really changes in a negative way, and negative meaning that it is much more biologically rich than it was before. And if the ecosystems aren't as healthy as they were before, since we all live our rich lives off of the ecosystem services that are provided, then they're not going to do as good a job decomposing waste. They're not going to do as good a job cleaning our water so that we can drink it, regulating our air, controlling erosion, pollinating our plants. We see what are happening now with the bee population, and yet like one third of our food crops are pollinated. So you have these kinds of problems besides the aesthetic enjoyment we get from it, the medicines that sometimes come from nature. I think something like one third of all the pharmaceuticals that we sell out there come pretty directly from nature, and just the emotional enjoyment and the sporting recreational activities we get from it. It provides for us in a very rich way. And so when the rate of species extinction exceeds the rate of speciation, and so, and since it has, kind of since the start of the Industrial Revolution, in fact, we have a much less rich nature, biologically rich nature than we have before, and our opportunities of how we make our livelihoods off of that, even if you don't care for, whether we have an obligation to other life forms, I happen to think we do, but even if you're looking at it from this selfish perspective of humanity, looking at it, we are impoverishing, if you will, future generations by causing a collapse to some degree, a loss of rich biological diversity. That's been going on, well, probably pretty much since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and it's accelerating now because of global warming.
I don't want to go away. I want to say one other thing about, you mentioned the elk. I'm fairly confident that more people have been injured by elk than by wolves.
Oh, yes. But it is, you ask me, you know, ask
exactly.
me,
little,
I mean, it is a very irrational thing. I mean, our organization, Defenders of Wildlife, is the organization that compensates ranchers in the West because they lose livestock to grizzlies and to wolves. And we recognize that there is a loss that they're experiencing there, and so we try to help make them whole in the process. But people lose sight of this. If a wolf takes down a calf someplace, it makes the story in the state newspaper and the local newspaper, and I can't know what the factor is, but I'll bet you they lose 50 to 100 times as many calves or you know, livestock of one form or another to domestic dogs every year than they do to wolves. But it is the emotional factor that plays in when wolves are the predator.
It was, I think, our friends in the Montana Nature Conservancy who've done a lot with trying to get things back as they were, who introduced us to the notion...
Before the arrival of Europeans.
Right. Introduced the idea that they in their thinking, and I'm sure this is a characteristic of you and lots of other people, have started building humans into the ecosystem, because mm-hmm. the humans are a part of the ecosystem. You mm-hmm. simply, well, there was a tendency early on to try to deal with a natural non-human environment as a separate entity from humans. And it seems to me, you know, a large part of the challenge, not only with respect to wolves, but for everything you're dealing with, that human piece, getting people, helping people to see the world around them in a different way, is just dead center of what you have
oh,
to
absolutely.
Do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you do that?
Well, you try. I mean, we try. You do it with education. I mean, we were talking about the wolves in particular a little while ago. You try to debunk the myths. We support various organizations that have kind of ambassador wolves that take them around to classrooms and to events. So we happen to have an event in Brooklyn. In fact, just next week, when there will be an ambassador wolf there. And we will you know, be letting someone see a wolf, you know, up close and personal. I used to bring them to my child's school when he was going to grade school. So we try to do the best we can, but you can't do it. There's not enough money in the world for nonprofit charitable organizations to accomplish this. You really need the media's attention. And the media has got a lot of things to write about, and they don't always pick the subjects that you think are important.
And so. Yet, if we're not paying attention to things that the Defenders of Wildlife pays attention to, you don't want me to support what you do just because it's nice. You want me to be looking at the life cycle, the life forms that make it possible to sustain life on Earth. We're going to talk a little later about global warming, because it's oddly enough a direct flip from wolves to global warming, which may not be obvious. And if we are looking strictly at the selfish, as you put it, our lives depend on this stuff.
Oh, yes.
It's like we depend on ants.
Oh, yes.
Well, let's look it up. Let's call it utilitarian.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Because
this is very utilitarian. If you take out the natural world, oxygen is the first thing oxygen and water.
We've got a lot at stake in all this, and I think probably lots of folks have done it, but the eminent evolutionary biologist at Harvard, Edward O. Wilson, has pointed out that it's very unfortunate for the planet and for all of the species that the species that happened to end up being in control, more or less, is one that doesn't have a very long-range view in the way we plan and undertake things. We do not plan in the long term. If we did, we would recognize that what we're doing in terms of the biodiversity of the planet is very important. He had a phrase that I often mention. One day I got to go back and look at it to make sure I get it exactly right. But he says that the loss of biodiversity is the folly for which future generations will be least forgiving when they look back on at us, because that is the infrastructure, the natural infrastructure that we make our livelihood off of, and future generations must make their livelihood off of. It's the most basic.
E.O. Wilson also says that we are a very young species and we'd better hurry up and grow up.
Yes.
Well. Roger Schlickhuysen is our guest. We'll be back in just a moment. Please be with us when we return. We are back. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. We are delighted to be with Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of Defenders of Wildlife. I'm sitting here looking at one of your wonderful magazines. You defend wildlife by telling us about them, by reminding us to be in love with the other creatures with whom we share the planet. How did you come to that?
Well, I don't want to tell you a long life story, but I didn't grow up being a conservationist as such. It kind of came to me later in life. And strangely enough, I got my graduate education in a place you would rarely think of for somebody that does what I do. I'm a Harvard Business School graduate. But I went to the Harvard...
Well, it's about time we be thinking about that, isn't it?
I went to the Harvard Business School not because I wanted to be a captain of industry, but because I just admired the way they taught people to think and make decisions, to be objective in their decision-making. And I never regretted it. I think that's very worthwhile. But over time, I found my way into the politics and into public policy, which was really my first love, and into the environment. And then looking back on my childhood in the West, which is where I grew up, primarily in Washington and Oregon, then I really appreciated it a great deal more. And at one point, about 17 years ago, when I was just finishing up a stint, second stint in the working in the U.S. Senate, a headhunting firm found me. And then our fairly small organization, Defenders of Wildlife, was looking for a new CEO. And the headhunting firm decided that I was the right person for them, which I was very grateful to hear their conclusion. And fortunately, the board decided that, too. So
it's interesting to me that you've got that piece that is the public policy, having worked in the Senate. All of these things are dramatically and tremendously political issues. You can't talk about any of these things.
No.
Whether you're talking about water or wolves or global climate change, or this is all political in the electoral sense as well as in the persuading people to see things differently.
Oh, yes. Well, you mentioned that what we do, part of what we do is education. But that's the softer side of Defenders, if you will. We're also fairly aggressive on the lobbying and advocacy front, especially with regard to the Congress and the administration. And we have a team of lawyers that like to sue the bastards if that's what you have to do. And during the last 8 years, we had to sue a lot. That was our last defense. It turned out that good science, good public policy, and sometimes even with the law on your side, it didn't matter. you were as aggressive as you could be, and you would go out and you would apply the law, and we were in court an awful lot.
This isn't necessarily a partisan issue. You had a lot of challenges during the Bush 2 administration, and that didn't stop when those guys walked out the door. This is something America has to deal with, quite apart from what party is holding
the
White House.
No, that's true. Scientists talk about the loss of biological diversity as being a particularly difficult problem because it is one that works its way through cumulative impacts. And you don't see it. Each time you want to fill in a wetland for one more development, or you want to, you know, allow one species that doesn't seem significant to wink out on you in some way, or to change the trade laws in some way that's going to disadvantage a particular species or whatever. All of those decisions individually are hard to see what they're doing collectively. But it is something that works its way over cumulative effects over time. And so it's very difficult. So we have one of the best laws in the world in the Endangered Species Act that should deal with this. But president after president and Congress after Congress have found that politically one of the most difficult laws to deal with because it runs right up into industry and development and mining and timbering and all these other things going on. And so some administrations and some Congresses have been better than others, but I have to tell you, I don't think there has been one that's really paid attention to the problem of endangered species the way they should. And you... I don't think the Endangered Species Act, for example, has ever been funded at more than $120 million per year. And this is the basic law we have for dealing with the loss of biological diversity, which I think is the main intergenerational problem that we have in our lifetime.
One of the, it seems, real challenges in addressing these kinds of issues, and it really, global climate change, is to me the biggest manifestation. We tend to assume that these changes are linear, that they're cumulative. And in fact, a lot of, particularly with respect to climate, these are nonlinear processes. It's not as if we have a steady increase and a steady amount of water melting. And
right.
There are tipping points in this where it gets very ugly very quickly.
Yes.
If you look at the climate record, the ice cores, there have been major shifts over very brief periods of time going back in history, not human caused, well, when humans were not in a position to make that kind of effect. But these are not linear systems. Very ugly things could happen very rapidly.
Yeah.
And we still think we have a lot of time to deal with it because we talk about 2020 and 2040 and 2050. But we're right up against it right now. In fact, it may be.
And 2040 isn't far away. And 2050 isn't
very far. Well, 2010 isn't far away.
Yes.
And oh, by the way, the ice caps are melting.
Yes. No. Every time in recent years where they've made a prediction about how fast we're going to be seeing the changes of a warming climate of climate change, 6 months later they're revising it. I mean, it should scare the bejesus out of everybody. And weather events become more and more erratic and extreme, and that's one of the chief signs, of course, of
global warming. You said intergenerational. David Orr, who is a great environmental educator, talks about us enslaving those generations that come after us by virtue of our actions now. Isn't justice in here somewhere, too?
Well, our legal system isn't built to protect future generations, unfortunately. I mean, it is. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, our Constitution thought this was so important that in the preamble it talks about it being to benefit our posterity. So, but then when you play it out and when the common law plays out, in fact, it's very, very hard to protect future generations. And I think the issue primarily is one of standing. Do you have standing to be in court? And to have standing, you have to show injury. Well, even if you knew that 100 years from now, something you were going to do was so damage future generations that 100 years from now, they would be harmed horribly. We don't have the trust responsibility under our legal system to be there standing in court for them. So there's no harm to us being there. I mean, that's pretty simple. That's pretty simplified, but that's basically it. So we don't have a legal system that was built in a manner where you could look at these far-ranging problems and look out for the interests of future generations. And our political system does pay attention to that in some ways, but pardon me if you often think it is mostly lip service, because there isn't anything much more American in terms of our values than caring for our children and our progeny, future generations. But when it actually comes to looking at the intergenerational issues that you have before you, it gets pretty difficult. We saw that debate playing out over the stimulus package. Mm-hmm. And those who were opposed to the stimulus package were making a point that we were piling debt onto future generations.
They didn't make that point when they were running the
Well, that's a different issue. That's true. They did not, but they did make the point. And I picked up, and it was very interesting to me to see that a phrase they developed is they called it generational theft. Now that's not quite as aggressive as saying we're enslaving future generations, but it's in the same direction. We're basically stealing from future generations. But if you and I think it is legitimate to look at the idea of piling on additional federal debt as a burden on future generations. The question that ethicists would ask in this situation is whether there are compensatory benefits. And of course, those who proposed and supported the stimulus package would say, yes, there are those benefits. In fact, we're providing for a healthier economy so that we will have jobs, we won't be destitute for decades, and we will generate the revenues to pay off that debt. In the same vein, there are no compensatory benefits from causing extinction and the loss of biodiversity. That is a net loss to future generations, any way you look at it. There are no compensatory benefits for damaging the biodiversity of the planet. And yet try to get our political system to talk about that when they're talking about issues like endangered species or, in fact, even global warming. That's something they just are uncomfortable talking in that manner, and in fact the media is uncomfortable covering it in that manner, which is unfortunate.
This question of standing raises the famous Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific, I think it's Southern Pacific, Union Pacific, Southern Pacific, which was actually did not, but and under common law established the personhood of corporations, which is a big part of what we're dealing with this, because it's not only, if we were just dealing with looking after the interest of humans with respect to the law, that is to have standing, it would be one thing, but we also have corporations who have standing as human beings, which gives them constitutional protections, which have allowed corporations to behave in ways, to do things, to exercise rights, nominally human rights, that have acted to seriously diminish the kinds of things you're dealing with. So much of what you're having to fight is not because people, the wolf thing is a little odd, but by and large what you're dealing with is corporate greed. You can make more money by destroying, or at least in the short term, you can make more money by digging up Wyoming, strip mining Montana, et cetera, and same thing with global climate change. So the role of corporations in this and their legal standing is a big part of the challenge we're faced with.
To which we'll come back in just a moment, and okay. You can think about that.
All right.
Forgive me interrupting, so I don't have to interrupt later. Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of Defenders of Wildlife, is our guest. We'll all be back in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. What a pleasure it is to be with Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of one of the great environmental and public policy groups, the Defenders of Wildlife. Bill Russell was just introducing the idea of how powerful corporations are in this conversation, that really we can't not talk about that.
Well, it was the long way around saying they are major players in all of what we're talking about.
Oh, they are. And, of course, that's coming home to the American public now because of our economic crisis. And, whether you call it greed or a profit motive run wild, that is a large part of what got us into the mess we're in. And it is at work with regard to devouring nature, if you will. They are not charged under their own charters and under our legal system with a social responsibility, if you will, of looking out for future generations and looking out for living nature. What they get rewarded for is next quarter's profits, and it's a very short-term view on things. And their responsibility is to the shareholders, and that it's expressed historically here pretty narrowly as being the maximum profits that you can make, the highest earnings per share that you can make. And we do pay a price for that. Now, there may have been a time when the world, including the United States, could tolerate that because, with fewer people, with, less nature-devouring technology than we have now, with less mouths to feed, less need for water than we have now, that you could have those kinds of impacts on nature and it could just absorb it. Well, we have passed that point now. You're talking about the tipping point. I don't know exactly where the tipping point came, but we've passed that point now. And if you could update the charters of corporations and ingrain in those charters more social responsibility, we'd all be better off. Well, it's pretty hard to unring that bell, I think.
It is indeed. And it's also, this is one of those things. We may be at a time in human history and the history of life on Earth where we have to figure out new ways to ring the bells. Corporations have not always been treated as, although they were not actually ever given the Supreme Court's blessing, they've not always been treated as persons. And there was a time when they died after 20 years. It was just part of the founders knew that there was a real challenge here. And they said corporations has to be in the state, can't own anybody else, ends at 20 years, the end. Well, these are political decisions. There's nothing written in stone that corporations have to be as they have been. And for people to begin to say, wait a minute, we need to think about this, is part of the work that a Defenders of Wildlife, that those of us who simply think of ourselves as active citizens, that we must begin to wake up from this numbness that has captured us over 30 or 40 years and say, there are big big things happening and life's threatened on Earth. What are we going to do about it?
Well, I do think that's right. I mean, we have the object lesson now of the economy being in trouble, the stock market being down, the credit markets being so much in trouble. And so there is more stimulants out there for us to look at this and examine those questions right now.
And the stakes are high.
The stakes are very high, and it's very difficult politically to do this. But even if you approach it, I think the most you hear the discussions going being in terms of recognizing that corporations provide the engines for growth in a capitalistic society that can be extremely beneficial. I mean, we have a high standard of living and quality of life that we have because of them. But more of a recognition that government has to set some boundaries around it. And so what we're examining,
because government is us.
That's us. And so we have to set the boundaries around saying what are the rules within these corporations have to operate. And there is a certain amount of healthy thinking going on right now looking at that again. It ends up being oversimplified into being how much regulation there is, but I think that's encouraging. The part of it that I wish it would go further, though, because what they're really saying there is they are still only looking at it through an economic lens. So if you could make the corporations more responsible by setting the boundaries in a better way and imposing regulations on them, so they had to operate within boundaries so that the economy could continue to grow and be healthy, that's as far as they go. But what we need to do in this day and age is not only to look at that, but how you make them more socially responsible in terms of their impact on the environment. And our job especially is to look at the impact on living nature, on biodiversity. And that's, we aren't to that point. I mean, no one, even the economic chaos we have right now is not stimulating that kind of discussion, unfortunately. But we desperately need that kind of discussion.
I had never thought, this is the first time I've thought of global climate change as an opportunity. But it is sort of a textbook case. I mean, what we're talking about is the whole ecology of Earth. But we have this specific condition, which is global warming, and we've got a pretty good idea of what the science around it is becoming clearer and clearer. And in a way, it is an opportunity to begin to, with respect to specific circumstances, develop the policies, develop the mindsets, develop the tools, develop the institutions necessary to address that specific challenge. But those same approaches can also be generalized, and the obvious case, of course, is carbon. We know the science is just overwhelmingly compelling that pumping the amount of CO2 into the air that we're pumping into the air is very, very, very destructive. We have to find a way of addressing that. Part of the challenge has been that we've externalized the cost of that.
Yes.
So there are tools that are both, a more enlightened view of economics, but also a more enlightened view of what it means to be a human in a political environment, that are available to us with a very specific focus and not an obvious deadline, but deadline in a very real sense. So in a way, this is an opportunity. Aren't we glad?
Well, if we recognize it, it's a horrible problem and challenge. The question is whether you recognize it as an opportunity, and it's hard. I mean, we're talking about global warming. I mean, the good news is, I think that the country, and again, the media keeps playing a hugely important role in this, over the last several years have finally begun to recognize just how dangerous global warming is. But they are having amazing problems in Congress, even with a president who is very much in tune with this problem and wants to do something about it, and a Congress which is more in tune with it than we've had in a long, long time. And yet you see in the news every day, how difficult it is to try to get a piece of legislation out there that will do more than just be a global warming bill in name, that will actually get at the issue of cutting greenhouse gas emissions, which is fundamental to this. But there is an additional problem, and again, being who I am, coming from an organization that's looking to protect biodiversity, I get very concerned that even more difficult than capping emissions in some way is getting the political establishment to recognize that the problem of global warming, the cause of global warming, is greenhouse gas emissions. The dreadful impact is on biological diversity. Trying to get an appreciable portion of the Congress to recognize that you aren't dealing with the problem wholly when you cut emissions, but you have to go on to try to deal with the impact on biological diversity. That's even more difficult. And I don't know how far you want to go into this, but a little while ago you were asking about the intergenerational aspects and kind of what's intergenerational justice. Well, we've got a perfect example here right now. We have some very, most people would say, progressive environmental congressmen who are proposing legislation to deal with greenhouse gas emissions that would say you would cap greenhouse gas emissions and then give back all of the federal revenues to their voters as rebates. Well, in terms of intergenerational equity, there isn't anything much more wrong-headed than that, because what you're doing then is you're subsidizing an unsustainable lifestyle rather than using that money to try to protect living nature, the biodiversity infrastructure that their children and future children are going to have to make their livelihoods off of. I mean, that we are basically subsidizing, you know, current lifestyles if we did that, rather than taking at least a portion of those federal revenues that came, for example, from a cap and trade system and reinvesting them in doing something like the Endangered Species Act should have done if Congress and presidents would have fully funded it, which is to build more resiliency into our ecosystems and into habitat so they can better withstand this pressure. We are going to lose a considerable amount of biodiversity from global warming. We can't avoid
that's
that.
That's done.
The question is, can you mitigate it? Can you mitigate the loss to an appreciable degree? And the answer is yes, you can. The big challenge is whether we can possibly find the political will to do it. So you have to find the political will, first of all, to cap emissions, and secondly, besides capping emissions, to recognize that that doesn't solve the global warming problem, that you have to deal with its impact. Not just the causes, but the impact. And that's very difficult. I can tell you, as somebody that's in Washington dealing with this from day to day, it's extremely difficult. And we've got champions. The country has champions in the Congress fighting for this. But it's very hard, and it's yet to be seen how it's going to play out.
Roger Schlickhuysen has honored us with his presence. We're all going to be back in just a moment. Come back with us. I'm Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. We're both delighted to be with Roger Schlickhuysen, who is the president of the wonderful Defenders of Wildlife. You were talking about next generations, those thereafter, being denied what looks like the ability to make a living. You're talking about being denied the ability to breathe, to have clean air, water. These are basic things. This isn't just how big is your mansion.
At its most extreme, that's it. I mean, presumably the water just wouldn't become undrinkable, but the quality would go down. The quality of the air will go down. You'll have more erosion. You'll have more extreme weather events. But even from another perspective, from the perspective of their opportunities, you know, we forge our rich lives off of the biodiversity that is provided to us by nature. And to the extent that we cut down on that biodiversity, that there is less biologically diverse nature out there than there was, we are reducing the opportunities that future generations will have compared to what we have, basically, to exploit that nature in our own self-interest. And we are shrinking biological diversity. It is becoming less, the planet is becoming less and less biologically diverse all the time, and is accelerating now due to global warming. And so from the perspective of what kind of opportunities, we have more opportunities to forge a rich livelihood from living nature, because there is more biologically diverse living nature out there than we are going to leave them with. And so in that sense, we are harming them. That's indisputable, fundamentally. That's apart from whether we so destroy the water and the air that they doesn't support life at all. But that is the result at its most extreme.
I want to talk about how to fix this.
That's quite a burden we have on that little wolf.
I mean, the wolf is part of it. The grizzlies are part of it. Global warming. I have the sense that we have a president whose instincts are good, who is willing to look at evidence as opposed to ideology, which is progress. I have the sense we have a Congress that is... In the worst case, the best government money can buy. But the funding of political campaigns is a problem, and we're seeing it in the in this energy legislation. The energy legislation. People are being peeled off because they have interest in coal, or because they're from an oil producing state or a gas producing state. Mm-hmm. And it seems that ultimately we, and this goes to the media challenge. We've got to bring the people along. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do get to vote. There's this other party out there that is the corporations that are a big part of how Congress behaves and how they make decisions. And it seems to me, real world, that we have a monumental challenge on our hand with respect to really two major constituencies. One is the corporate environment, and the other is the general public, neither one of which are convinced of the kinds of things we're talking about. How do we move that?
Well, the only way you can do it is first of all through the media deciding it's a problem. And it was when the media decided that global warming was a problem that the public got it. I mean, I don't think there is any way to get there short of the media understanding that. And so you did get there to a certain degree. If I whine about this, it's because the media didn't take the next step of realizing that the global warming problem went beyond cutting emissions, that it has to do with the impact, that how serious that is. But the media is key on it. Then, of course, what shapes the media? Groups like ours try to shape the media, but we're one voice out there trying to get their attention. And sometimes we're successful, a lot of times you're not. Everybody's trying to get their attention for something. You hope that our political leaders will speak out on this. You hope the president will. He's the best messenger that we've got on this sort of issue right now. And they're playing it, I'm not casting value judgments. They're playing it the way they think is best. And right now, in this environment, they think politics responds best to something if it looks like it's going to help the economy and it's going to help jobs. And that's their message points right now. And you can't see them on TV or on radio or read the newspapers any day without recognizing that's where they're playing this. And they may be making the absolute right choice there. But in doing that, they aren't talking about the kind of problems I've been talking about, which is the impact of global warming on biological diversity. They don't think... My guess is they don't see that as winning votes in Congress. And what they're about is trying to see how you win votes in Congress. And what I hope is that while they're winning votes in Congress, first of all, they'll be successful. But because we haven't emphasized the problem of the impact of biological diversity, we don't leave that on the cutting room floor. You've got so that you have people out there, including, again, what you would think of as normally very much pro-environmental congressmen out there saying, okay, we'll cap emissions, but let's give all the money back to consumers. But if nobody's telling that there's a problem, that we have to deal with the impact, they're liable to do that. The unfortunate thing is it's possible to have a balance in all that. And there should be enough federal revenues, depending upon how the cap and trade legislation is enacted, that you can handle a lot of problems, including providing a significant amount of money that can go to the federal government, to state governments, and to tribal governments to help them deal with the biodiversity loss problem. It has to be dedicated money that does that, though, because given the budget situation and the history, for example, I was telling you about the Endangered Species Act, if you have to depend upon future Congresses and presidents to appropriate those billions of dollars per year, it will never happen. So it has to be dedicated money that comes out of the federal revenues that come from the sale of these emission allowances.
There's also a role for good old-fashioned citizens in this, isn't there?
There is, if they're, and I have a great deal of faith in the American public, if they recognize that it's a problem. Yeah. But if there isn't, there aren't leaders telling them it's a problem, and the media, I kind of, I'm not trying to beat up on the media, but it's, they shape everybody's opinion on this. If the media are unwilling to tell them what a serious problem this is, then I guess, you know, we can't be too upset that the public isn't rising up and saying, protect my children and my children's children and their children's children, because we have to do something about saving biodiversity. I'll bet you the values are there. The values are there. I think no one cares more in America than about anything other than caring for their children and their grandchildren and future generations. There are values there to touch, but you need a vehicle, a way to awaken those values and touch them. And we're missing that. And the political debate, the whole direction of the political debate on global warming legislation is how can we cap emissions? And if you have a certain amount of federal revenues that comes from the sale of the allowance of those, how do you buy enough votes to get a majority so that you can cap the emissions? And then the question is whether there's anything left for dealing with the impacts of biodiversity. And I worry a great deal that there may not be enough left. But first of all, you've got to get the legislation. You've got to cap the emissions. But that's the only train that's going to leave on this. You've got to have, if it's global warming legislation and it deals with the problem, it has to both cap emissions and it has to deal with the impact on biological diversity. Or future generations, to paraphrase Ed Wilson, are going to look back on us and blame us for this, and they will be right to do so.
Was Ed Wilson that said that we are in the midst of another great extinction event. The difference is, instead of being an asteroid, it's humans.
Well, that's right, and they've been saying that for decades. And that was before you put the impact of global warming on top of that. I mean, we could lose 35-40% of our species. You know, talk about tearing holes in the web of life. The web of life can tolerate a certain amount of insult. But not at that level. You're clearly going to be causing damage here, and anybody will get that intrinsically if they have a chance to think about it.
And those earlier extinction events, some of them wiped out 90-95% of all life on Earth. So
yes,
this is not. I don't think it's hyperbole when Wilson talks about it that we are working our way there, and humans cannot survive without other life forms. In spite of what
no,
we think. Our
no,
technology
we,
isn't that advanced.
We make our livelihood off of that, those other life forms.
One of the great success stories of the 20th century was the civil rights movement. And in some ways, it drug politicians kicking and screaming into a different way of seeing things. And I ask that because it's real tempting to say, well, we elected Obama, let him take care of it. We have Congress, let them take care of it. And the media piece of this is absolutely essential. But there are things, attitudes, making noises, doing whatever, that individuals and groups of people in the community, electoral politics aside, that people can do that will begin to have an impact. And ultimately, and I think of the March on Washington, where the leaders, the group of leaders, was not leading, they were following. They were in the middle of the program.
To which we will return in just a moment with Roger Schlickhuysen from the Defenders of Wildlife. Please be with us. We do have a couple more minutes with the president of Defenders of Wildlife, Roger Schlickhuysen. Bill Russell, you were saying the civil rights movement.
Or should we just spend all our energy pounding on Washington?
Well, yeah, that is how you get things done. It is the squeaky wheel, and you do need to pound on Washington. Groups like ours try to do that. There are a lot of issues out there demanding attention, and I keep coming back to the media because it is the media that decides which of those issues groups are going to be successful. So you try as best you can, and we try in the courts, and we try through our magazine, through lobbying. But if the public would demand it, you know. The civil rights movement was one of the great movements that we had. An advantage that the civil rights movement had compared to those that say work to save biodiversity is that the insults and the harm are so immediate. You can just see them right now, and you can catch them on TV. It's pretty hard to catch an extinction event on television, let alone its significance. So it gets back to the particular difficulty that we have with the problem of lost biological diversity. It's very hard to make that immediate, to make it felt, you know, by the public in a very meaningful way. The environmental movement benefited years ago when the Cuyahoga River caught fire.
The pollution
side of this, you know, benefited, if you will, from that, because there was something very, very visual from that. But we've proceeded, you know, we've been somewhat successful in a lot of our environmental laws. You don't have those kind of extreme events happening that often. And in the loss of biological diversity, it's pretty hard to capture it on television anywhere.
And yet, it is that ability of the human animal to be empathetic that continues to be why I am drawn to people like the Defenders of Wildlife. In your spring 2009 issue, you have a bear, a grizzly bear, not just any bear, hiding behind a tree because a mother coyote is saying, "You stay away from my babies." Well, that image to me is one of those things of, you know, humans really can get it if we're given the chance.
Oh, I think so. No, I agree, and we just hope, you know, through our work, and we have a lot of allies in the conservation community and the sporting community that are trying their best to try to help people get it, to get the, you know, and it's, you know, we'll see whether we're successful or not. I hate to look back years now and think I just didn't try hard enough.
When you say sporting community, that is an opportunity I think most people overlook. There are lots of people who care about the planet who are not, like I, a tree hugger.
Oh, yeah. No, there are a lot of very responsible sportsmen. I mean, in recreational, whether you're hunters or fishermen or somebody just likes to enjoy, commune with nature and take good photographs of nature.
Can't they get to those who want to slaughter
wolves? They're trying. I mean, we've had events recently, just a couple of weeks ago. We had a lobby day on the Hill, and we had 18 groups with us. It was Defenders of Wildlife. We had the Garden Club of America with us. We had Trout Unlimited with us. The Association of State of Fish and Wildlife Agencies that represents the state fish and game agencies in all of the 50 states. It's a pretty wide spectrum, but even with the, I think there were 18 of us, you know, on that day and sponsoring this big lobby day and the reception on Capitol Hill, even so, it's hard to get your voice up there. It's hard to elevate your issue, but there's no question there's a broad coalition of people that see that it's in our interest and in future generations' interest to deal with this problem and to deal with it in the global warming legislation that is being fought over in Congress right now.
Well, can we take up a collection to arm the wolves?
Well, with that thought, we will wish you well. Thank you for coming and invite you to come back when next the opportunity
Thank
is
you.
There.
It was my pleasure, Paula and Bill. I enjoyed it.
For millennia, humans have acted as if nature were somehow separate from us, something to be controlled and exploited. The folly of that view is becoming more manifest each day. The work that Roger Schlickhuysen does is critical to our individual and collective well-being. We thank him and the millions of other people around the world who are striving to make our future sustainable. We hope that the media will soon join that effort. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.